What if I told you that you can support your blood pressure and healthy CoQ10 levels with two chews a day? The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. That's like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 supports your cardiovascular health. Visit RadioBeats.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply on bundles and save 15% with the promo code DEAL.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Mater Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Ireland's COVID infection rate became the worst in the world and became an eye-opener for other countries who wanted to avoid the situation that we found ourselves in. But have we reached the peak of the third wave? Well, to talk about this, I'm joined by Professor Sam McConkie. Sam, good morning and welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Pat.
We're in a terrible state, really, aren't we? And do you think it could have been avoided if we had not pandered to vested interests?
I'm not sure if it was only vested interest. It may have been just our hope and desire and wish to do normal type shopping and socialising in December. We were sold this idea that if we had early restrictions in October and November, we were a few weeks, you know, coming into restrictions in October. Most other countries, and that very well controlled our second ripple, if you like. But then, of course, the quid pro quo was that we were also sold this idea that then we'll open up restaurants and socialising in December, we'll all do our shopping, we'll all meet multi-generational meetings over Christmas. And we've learned to our cost, and I think everyone around the world has learned, that if you do that for 3 or 4 weeks from, you know, numbers of coronavirus in the community at a couple of hundred, it can rapidly go up to very, very high levels. I am happy to see, of course, that numbers have come down the last 2 weeks. The positivity rate and testing has come down. Of course, sadly, the number of deaths hasn't yet levelled off or come down, and the number of people in ICUs hasn't really come down yet. But I'm hoping that that will happen in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
There has been an attempt to blame the new variant. The WHO and our own Michael Ryan does not necessarily point the finger at the new variant. We were well underway towards this third wave before the third wave, English variant, or the English mutant, as Angela Merkel put it, struck.
I feel we have to avoid nationalism at this time, Pat. We should not label it one country or another. Let's call it B117. It was discovered in Kent, Essex, in England, but the English are very good at sequencing virus. So it may be just that they actually sequence more and found it more. It reminds me of, you know why the Spanish flu is called the Spanish flu? It's not that it started in Spain. It's that after the First World War, media in almost all countries were on a wartime blackout and couldn't tell the whole truth, if you like, as you know, often happens in wartime situations. But in Spain, who weren't in the First World War, the media were allowed to tell the story. So this was purely a function of lack of media censorship in Spain and openness about the story. So I think I would plead with all of us not to become nationalistic. That actually is going to make this worldwide problem of coronavirus worse. So B117 certainly is a little bit of a factor, but new variants are par for the course in RNA viral pandemics. We saw a different strain in March and April than we had in coming from China initially in February. So there have been wave after wave of change and diversity and evolution of variants all the way through this 1 year of pandemic. So this is just another one, and it you know, it can be controlled. We've shown that it, you know, it can be controlled by sort of social distancing things, as we've done before. And it's currently grown from about 1 in 20 cases at the beginning of December up to about half of cases now. But it's not, that still means the other half is the old COVID-19. So we're dealing with the same problem that we were last year, sadly.
Now, do you feel we have enough data on all of this? Because we are not testing close contacts anymore.
So that was a pragmatic decision, that our testing capacity was maxing out. So doing the day 5 and day 10 tests on close contact were stopped so that we could test symptomatic people who are not contacts of anyone. And they're a very important group to test, because then they need to go into their isolation, and their family or contacts and the family need to go into contact. So I think that was the right decision back, 3-4 weeks ago. As we now have numbers dropping, I'm hoping that the number of new symptomatic people drops and we're able to go back to testing close contacts again. And that would be...
But you know what I mean? There is a data deficit there. We can't really know. And I was listening to Minister Michael McGrath this morning on our breakfast show, and he was saying that nobody anticipated that the numbers would remain so stubbornly high. You know, the people who got COVID around Christmas time went on to give it to other people. So
exactly.
Once you have huge numbers of people out there with it, whether they're symptomatic or otherwise, they're giving it to other people. That's the problem.
So it's inevitable that when somebody caught it over Christmas from socialising, that then they will share it with their immediate household contacts to some extent. It is sort of a next generation of viral transmission. But then there are also some people who, you know, have to go out for essential work, and they're obviously at some risk of catching it. So I don't think we can expect it to come down much quicker than it is. We have closed construction. We've closed a lot of non-essential work. We're very simple. Tony Hulan's telling us to stay at home. It couldn't be sort of conceptually simpler. So we all understand what's been asked of us. And really, things have improved in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I'm hoping we'll continue to improve. The question really in my mind now for us as public policy is in late March, beginning of April, when numbers are down to 5 or 10 cases a day, I hope, how do we then put in place the systems to keep it down? And that possibly involves much faster testing. So rather than more testing, which is what many of our political leaders have been calling for, I'm saying faster testing. So you have a turnaround time of just maybe 3 or 6 hours from the time somebody gets symptoms to the time they get a positive test. Then that their contact tracing is done within an hour or two, much faster contact tracing. Even if that's at, you know, midnight, getting a call back at midnight to say, your test earlier today was positive. Who are your contacts? They and you should not go to work tomorrow. You should stay in your room. You should isolate completely. I think that would be helpful. Now, I know it does involve people working at midnight, but that's maybe okay. Similarly, contact tracing on site. So if there's a little outbreak, you know, here in Clontarf, where I am, maybe a pop-up tent, an incident tent, and like we have with the Garda Síochána and a major murder or whatever, a little white tent where people can come and get tested, no questions asked. Rather than having to drive to Swords or Croke Park, you can just get your test done immediately and really quickly and conveniently, almost bringing the testing to the people where the outbreaks are happening. So there's several things that I think we could do better and additionally to keep it down. Obviously, this 14-day mandatory quarantine is something that I've been advocating for you know, about 9 months, and I would strongly support that, because we really don't want to
It fell on deaf ears. A report in today's Irish Times from Harry McGee: almost half of recent arrivals did not confirm their place of residence. That's the headline. They were contacted by telephone to confirm their place of residence, and they either failed to do so or they refused to do so. What does that tell you about the way we've run this show?
Right now, when we're in such a bad place, it perhaps is a less important issue. But in March and April, when I'm hoping our numbers will be much lower, then it becomes an increasingly important issue. So it's sort of, at present, we're in this get the numbers down phase. But once we've got them down, then the next stage becomes keep it down. And in keeping it down, preventing reimportation, whether it's from Northern Ireland or Britain or America or wherever, is really important. We also would need a clear border strategy. There are tools and plans and detailed ways of having buffer zones and having even testing sewage in the villages around the border to ensure that there's no coronavirus. Unfortunately, it gets into the sewage path, and you can test the sewage sort of from a village and see,
but they've been doing this in Australia. They've been doing this in Australia for months.
They have. You know, and I know
What is it about us here that the great ideas and the very effective ideas, and I keep on mentioning every single day antigen testing. I'm aware of one nursing home where they've just said to hell with what the public health people are telling us. We're going to do antigen testing ourselves to detect when our staff might be infectious, and they go home and they do it every day. You know, that is the way to keep infections down. Testing sewage was another way to detect outbreaks perhaps early.
The Australians and most of the Asian countries, in fairness to them, they all had on their shelf a well-worked-out, thoroughly rehearsed practice plan to deal with SARS-1. So because SARS-1 was so threatening on their doorstep back 17, 18 years ago, they said, this is inevitably going to come back. Let's make a detailed plan. So on the 23rd of January, when they saw in Wuhan the Chinese Communist Party, all these people coming in, and they realised this is a coronavirus, they had a plan for dealing with a coronavirus pandemic in their population, and they implemented that very, very quickly between the 23rd and 25th of January.
So, Sam, that brings me to the point that I was going to make about the numbers in recent days. 93 people died, most of them in January, a few dating back from December, and one, it was undetermined when exactly the death from COVID-19 was attributed. But 93, looking at the median age, which is 82, which means that half of them are over 82 and half of them are under 82. Yeah. But it certainly points to an elderly population. We've seen headlines in our newspapers about nursing homes where multiple deaths have occurred. So was the huge death toll in nursing homes last March, April, not our SARS warning? And we've had almost a year in the meantime to put in something in place to avoid deaths in nursing homes a second time round, and we have failed abysmally.
I think we all are shocked and recognise that our plan through December largely failed, and it the rates rose shockingly fast, and there's almost a stunned shock at how bad a situation we were in by the 26th of December. So I have to say, I think we're all in a sense of national failure, and that does have impacts on healthcare systems, not just even for COVID, but even people for other conditions. Everything's deferred and put off because the hospitals are full of people with COVID. So it's had a big impact, and certainly on the families and the people who've died, it's had the ultimate impact. And I know people think, oh, 83, that's, you know, maybe very old, but it really isn't. People at 83 often have, you know, 5 or 8 years of good, happy life to be alive. If you talk to people, they really want to live another 5 or 10 years. So it's the life expectancy in Ireland has really grown dramatically over the last 20, 30 years. And, you know, when 83 would have been seen as very, very old 30 years ago, now many people are living healthily up to their late 80s.
But the point being that what we saw, the virus was culling the weakest, those who were very elderly and very sick in nursing homes back last year, and is doing the same. What did we not learn?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I think there's a lot of learning to do. I think we hope to have some normality of Christmas, both our social life. I mean, I don't know, the German TV and Belgian TV, you were on to me asking, how do we go from being the best in Europe to the worst in the world? And what I said was that in our culture, Pat, it's part of our essence to kind of come back home at Christmas and meet our family, meet our extended family, meet our friends in the place we grew up, do a bit of chatting, a bit of socialising. And this is, I think, a bit unique in Ireland, that we, for us, it's a bit like Eid in the Middle East, that people feel a duty of care to their elderly ones and their extended family to actually socialise with them at Christmas. And that's part of our essence. I was, you know, 10 or 12 years abroad.
But Sam, it's part of the essence of the Americans and the Canadians who had Thanksgiving different weekends. Yeah. In Canada, we saw a surge after their Thanksgiving. In the United States, a massive surge from which they have not yet recovered after their Thanksgiving. So, you know, what is it that we think we are somehow immune because it's all about Christmas?
You know, I think the hope was, if I can sort of describe where the government, I think, thought and never thought, that by really good controls in October and November, we'd get the number of cases down to tiny numbers by the beginning of December. And then with the relaxations in December, because we were starting from a very low base, it would stay low. The problem was the numbers weren't low at the beginning of December. It was still 200 to 400 cases a day. And then it very rapidly doubled and rapidly quadrupled and went up, you know, of course, to 8,000. So really, we had this sort of almost a deal, a quid pro quo. Let's all go into early restrictions in October, November, get the case numbers down to tiny numbers like we did in June, and then it'll stay low. But it didn't stay low because it wasn't low enough. So this is where time-based guidance for the population isn't so good. Rather than saying we should open up on Paddy's Day or the end of March, I think we have to say, let's open up things once we've got it under control. And once the number of daily cases are so low that we're confident that we can keep them low using really detailed, thorough, fast testing and tracing and local pop-up testing and local contact tracing.
The hope seems to be that we get the vaccine out to as many people as possible, and then we won't have to try to make the hard yards. You know, the hard yards are stopping people coming in, quarantining them in hotels, serving them, you know, their food, leaving it outside the door on a tray for 14 days, testing and testing and testing again. You know, I keep mentioning places I know, Bermuda, you know, before you emerge from that quarantine, you might have had three different tests And when you're all clear on three, sequentially over a fortnight, then you emerge. We are unwilling to embark on that kind of process. So are we pinning all our hopes on a rapid vaccination program so that we don't have to do the hard things?
I'm not confident.
We've lost you, Sam, there. Just if you could say that all again. Yeah, go on.
So I'm not confident, Pat, that vaccines prevent transmission. The vaccine studies, the big phase 3 study, have showed they prevent disease and death and that they're safe. And that's a good thing. Being safe and preventing death is really a wonderful thing. But they're not confident yet. The data isn't out yet. It's just coming in February to see to what extent they prevent transmission of the virus from one vaccinated person to others. And that's what we hope it will work, but we really don't have that information yet. So it's too early to make that conclusion about vaccines, that they will help to prevent transmission, because in primate studies some have not prevented transmission. The primates, the monkeys that got it, still got an upper respiratory infection. They still had a viral replication in their nose and throat and still were shedding live virus that could infect other monkeys. So we really don't have the evidence yet, but we'll have it hopefully in February about the impact.
Okay, so we shouldn't pin our hopes entirely on the vaccine stopping the spread. Only those who've got the vaccine will be protected if, you know, they are in the 90% of the cohort who will be protected. 10% may remain unprotected. But what you're saying is that those who remain unvaccinated, you've really got to wait until 80% or thereabouts are vaccinated to get this legendary herd immunity, because the virus needs hosts, and if it doesn't have hosts, then it just goes away.
And I'm yes, that is what I'm saying. Although, to be really clear, I'm not saying that it's definitely ineffective at preventing transmission. I'm saying we don't know yet. The data is not out there. It's important to distinguish an absence of data from a confident no. Sure. And at this point, we just don't know.
The question, though, of what we do about people coming in, you know, we're talking about testing, but we don't seem to enforce anything. You know, you ask people to do things and hope they do things, but there's no guarantee they'll do things. And, you know, we got the numbers down, not to the level we wanted to before Christmas, but we also knew that we were going to have a huge influx of people coming in from the United Kingdom. We knew that. We already had evidence in the border counties that things were not going well, given the level of infection in Northern Ireland. So, you know, why could we? Was it kind of an overbearing optimism that crushed scientific analysis?
It's judging and looking back on the world is, you know, in medicine, we call it the retrospectoscope, or you might call it the benefit of hindsight. And it's often, it's like filling in the crosshair crossword in Irish Times after it's been filled in already by somebody else. I can sort of say, oh yeah, I see how that clue makes sense and gives you this answer. But that doesn't mean I can do it quickly when I start to do it for the first time. So it's very easy with retrospective.
Sam, to suggest that they had no information, that they could not read the tea leaves from, as I say, Thanksgiving in Canada, Thanksgiving in the United States, the German Christmas markets being shut down by Angela Merkel, all of those kind of things. They were there for us to see. And also we knew huge numbers of people, in spite of ministerial pleas to people not to come home for Christmas. We knew all you had to do is check with the airlines on their bookings and you could have found that out. And I'm sure they did. So they had all this evidence. They just chose to ignore it.
Well, where I would look is forward and suggest that we have tens of thousands of empty hotel rooms in Ireland right now, and we have tens of thousands of hotel workers who are currently on pandemic unemployment payment because the international tourism trade is gone. So reutilising those hotel rooms and the staff to cook and look after the people and say, you're in mandatory 14-day hotel room, full bed and full board, you know, with a Wi-Fi and a telephone and a fast internet and a television so you can entertain yourself until your 14 days are over. That's very feasible. And we've seen, of course, the tennis players in Australia are being forced to do that. That is a feasible thing that wouldn't cost us very much because all the facilities and staff are already there. And I suspect the hotels and the workers would rather be doing that than at present doing absolutely nothing. So I think there are solutions there to that we should implement for March, April, May, until we've really found permanent long-term solutions to this coronavirus problem.
But also, you know, at the beginning, the Australians were hosting people who wanted to come into Australia or had to come in or whatever. Eventually, though, people had to pay for themselves. I mean, if you want to come in, given the state of the pandemic, you've got to be in a hotel. We'll charge you a nominal figure, not the typical Dublin boom time, €400 a night. It could be something more like 70 or 80 euros a night, literally the cost of servicing the room and cleaning the room, and you pay then for your own food. Then you'd only get the people coming in who needed to come in.
Yeah, I think the who pays is a separate issue, and you know that's an economic issue, and it may be some balance, and you have to work out sort of projecting the supply and demand and how the payment will affect that, and are people able to afford it. But I would strongly advocate that we go down this route of reusing our hotels at this time for this purpose, and I'm a bit agnostic about who actually pays or how that's paid for. That's a sort of a separate issue, but I do think it's worked very well in many countries, is having this mandatory hotel quarantine. And we could do that.
I was looking at a report on COVID transmission in poorly ventilated spaces. Again, the science on that is quite clear. If you don't have ventilation, you're much more likely to catch the virus. And what did we do? We opened up our hospitality before Christmas. Most of them, you know, okay, the big super pubs and so on, the super gastro pubs and the expensive restaurants, plenty of ventilation, but most places do not have air conditioning or anything like it. Many of the doors and windows were shut because of the cold and all the rest of it. These were petri dishes for infection. I noticed there isn't a bip out of the hospitality industry now because they know that they contributed to the surge.
Yeah, and the issue, of course, in hospitality is that you can't wear a mask while you're eating and drinking. So in supermarkets and other areas, I think because we're wearing masks, that does protect against some of the spread from airborne transmission. But unfortunately, when you're sitting down and eating and drinking, especially if you're within 2 or 3 metres of people and you don't have a mask on, obviously you can't, then even just talking, what we've learned now, surprisingly, even just talking as we are now, generates some little tiny globules of liquid that some will have virus in it if one person has it, and that those will spread through the air. So wearing a mask is really key, and good ventilation is key. And
The research is from the University of Cambridge and Imperial College London, and they've done mathematical models and so on. But they found that when two people, just two, are in a poorly ventilated space and neither is wearing a mask, prolonged talking is far more likely to spread the virus than a short cough.
Yeah.
So there you are.
So talking is a risk, and especially if it's forceful, loud talking, then it produces more droplets. So this is an issue, that talking together. So I guess the take home message here is wear a mask when you're out and doing anything if possible.
All right, we will leave it there, Sam. Thank you very much for your insights. That's Professor Sam McConkie.